Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Gregory S. Paul, renowned researcher and illustrator who has helped establish the new look of pterosaurs, dinosaurs, and other Mesozoic creatures. And we're talking about his new book, The Princeton Field Guide to Pterosaurs. Greg, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Great to be here.
Now, I'm sure like a lot of people, and myself is in this group, is, you know, I was one of those kids who became enamored of Mesozoic creatures. And even then, the pterosaurs were sort of a weird group for me. Like, I knew about Rhamphorhynchus, I knew Pteranodon, I think I knew Dimorphodon, but they all just sort of seemed to be out there to the side. This book is a revelation about the variety of forms that these creatures had. What are pterosaurs, to be specific? Are they reptiles or are they dinosaurs?
Well, they're not dinosaurs.
Okay.
The term reptile is really ambiguous. It's kind of hard to define all these things these days. You know, reptiles used to be lizards and crocodiles and turtles and stuff like that, and dinosaurs and so on. Officially, under the new phylogenetic taxonomic system, reptiles include birds. And even when I was young, birds are often called glorified reptiles.
Yeah.
Birds and crocodilians and lizards and turtles, dinosaurs and all this stuff. And it's kind of a phylogenetic thing. So pterosaurs are reptiles, but then again, so are birds in this sense. So that doesn't really tell us a whole lot. They're not the classic reptiles. And I actually have some problems with the way these words are being defined these days.
Yeah, yeah.
So what they are archosaurs.
Okay.
And archosaurs include crocodilians and include dinosaurs and pterosaurs and what used to be called thecodonts, which are now a whole bunch of groups, pseudosuchians and stuff like that. So they're in that basic group, and the only surviving archosaurs are crocodilians and birds. And that group includes a group that's called the ornithodirons. And those are pterosaurs, the probable ancestors of pterosaurs and the ancestors of dinosaurs and birds. So they're a subgroup of archosaurs.
How well do we understand the evolution of pterosaurs?
Not as well as we'd like.
Because I was straight lining you on that, Greg.
Well, there's a problem here. With birds, we have a pretty good fossil record because birds started appearing in the middle Jurassic. What would that be? About 160 million years ago. And fortunately, there are a lot of good fine-grained lagerstätten deposits. I'm probably mispronouncing that. That are, you know, those wonderful lake beds or island lagoon beds. These fine deposits that the skeletons fall on and preserve very exquisitely, small skeletons. And since birds are showing up at that time, we have a pretty good fossil record of them and how they evolved from dinosaurs. From the Triassic period, when we're talking about how long, it would have been about 220 million years ago, something like that, when the pterosaurs were evolving, we really don't have those kind of deposits. And so this is a big problem with sorting out what's going on. A similar thing occurs with bats, for example. Bats started evolving very early after the dinosaurs went out. And there are really no good deposits for finding these things in. So we don't know how bats evolved very well. So we have a problem there. There is this group of small early archosaurs, the early ornithodirons, lagopedids, I think they're called, who do seem to have a few pterosaur features that suggest that they evolved from these small gracile things, a couple feet long, some of which were climbing and that sort of thing. And that's probably where it got started. But we don't have a really nice record of that transition. The earliest pterosaurs we find already have fully developed wings or flying around.
Yeah.
Again, with bats, we don't have transitional types. Unlike dinosaurs, you have proto-birds that have reduced wings and obviously limited flight capability, and they were getting better with time.
But there's been a renaissance in the last several decades because new fossils have come up of pterosaurs, but from places like China and Argentina. And some of the forms that have come up in the last half century are just mind-blowing to look at, and especially through your illustrations. They look like I'm looking at an alien life form.
Yeah, some of those fossils go back a ways. Now, the big thing that occurred, and occurred in my lifetime back in the 70s, was the finding of Quetzalcoatl.
Oh, yeah, mine too. I'm old enough to remember it.
Yeah, up till then, it had been the biggest one is Pteranodon and some of its relatives, which are pretty big themselves. But then it was just this mind-blowing thing because it was just so much bigger and far more impressive. Originally, it was going to be called Pteranodon gigas. But the guy then, a guy named Lawson, who was working on it, realized it wasn't Pteranodon and named it Quetzalcoatlus. And that was just a huge revolution because there have been all these calculations done showing Pteranodon is as big as you can get and still fly. No. And so that came in. Yeah, it's all tied in. In general, the dinosaur renaissance is also a part of this because pterosaurs are kind of in that same gestalt. You got a lot of people out there working, looking at digging up fossils. So we've got this big influx of these things that do look really weird, although we have to remember, you know, if elephants were extinct, who would ever restore the way they really look? You know, those trunks and those big ears on African elephants. You know, elephants are really weird looking. So, you know, we have bizarre things today. And, you know, there are some birds today that have big crests on them that look weird. And that's hornbills.
Nothing like a pterosaur. I'm sorry, Greg.
That's true. But also, you know, it's because we're not used to them. And, you know, pterosaurs have a wing membrane. Bats look kind of weird, you know, when you think about it.
Yeah.
So,
But let's talk about the wing membrane.
Out of our norm.
Yeah, let's talk about the wing membrane. How are they flying? Now, you have excellent chapters in your book. And I want to mention that you just don't, you know, people don't understand how a person like you works. You don't just draw what you think it looks like. It requires a tremendous amount of research and understanding how muscles attach to bodies and so on and so forth. So for a pterosaur, what is the wing like? Is it just a skin?
No, it's not. It's not like bat wings. They have these, you know, a number of fingers that are supporting a very thin, pretty uniform membrane. Pterosaur wings are much more complicated. They only have that one really big leading edge wing finger supporting the membrane, nothing else. And it's a stiffer system. It's multi-layered. There's one layer that consists of these fibers, these fairly stiff, they're not bony, but fairly stiff fibers that run through the outer wing, most of the wing. They help stiffen it and give it camber, give it that aerodynamic shape. And there's another level of blood vessels and that sort of thing, and there's skin layers on both sides and so on. So it's a pretty sophisticated system, still probably thin enough that you could see through it. I mean, you couldn't see through it. You would get a light going through it.
Yeah,
so if you're looking at a big pterosaur flying over and the sun was behind it, it would kind of look like a bat wing that you could be somewhat translucent, but thicker than bat. In fact, it actually weighs a lot. Ezer Laramendi, who's in Spain, and I, we've been working on body masses of various animals, including pterosaurs, and the calculations show that wing membrane was 10% of the weight of the animal. Because they're big membranes, and it adds up, even if they're really thin. That's about twice as much as is in a bat. But then again, because bats have thinner membranes, and again, bats have those fingers helping support the membrane, so the total weight contribution is about the same. In birds, the feathers make up around, 6% of the weight of the animal.
Well, if these membranes ever get torn, is that it for the pterosaur? Or how do we understand about how they could heal them? Or?
You know, I was just watching some crows flying overhead last evening, and a lot of them have lost a lot of their feathers.
Right. It's that time of the year.
Yeah. Yep. And it's more of a crisis for these things. Now, bats have incredible wing membrane recovery systems. They can take an injury and it'll heal up pretty fast. It doesn't always work, but it can do that. And some of the membrane in the pterosaur seems to be serving a similar function, that it would probably be harder to tear than a bat membrane because it's thicker and more supported. But if it did, it would be a fairly decent chance of it healing up. But, yeah, it'd be a risk. So that's one of the problems that they may have had.
Now, you mentioned birds before. Birds were in existence where pterosaurs were existing. So what was going on?
Pterosaurs evolved earlier. Pterosaurs are
but they overlapped. They overlapped with birds, right?
Yeah, and then I guess birds would have shown up about 40 million years later, the first very primitive birds. They really started competing in the Cretaceous, the early Cretaceous, when you started getting sophisticated birds. And but there's some controversy about this now, but by the end of the Cretaceous, birds seem to be more numerous, a lot more species, doing more stuff. On the other hand, the giant pterosaurs, their juveniles, would have been competing with the birds. You don't have any small pterosaur, adult pterosaurs towards the end. First pterosaur started out small.
Well, then those are the rhamphorhynchoids?
Yeah, but also the earliest pterodactyloids.
Yep.
And then in the early Cretaceous, a little bit in the late Jurassic, particularly the early Cretaceous, around 120 million years ago, you start getting these really, really big pterosaurs, particularly marine ones early on, you know, with wingspans of 20 to 30 feet or so.
Jeez.
And they, so they appear, and then the smaller pterosaurs are fading away. And how much of that is because of competition for birds, or how much is it that these big pterosaurs, because, major point here, lots of birds, when they're hatched, don't do anything for a long time. They're in a nest until they're fully grown and fed by their parents. Some birds are different. They will get out of the nest very quickly, like ostrich young, mm-hmm. and also megapode fowl from Australia and so on. They fly almost as soon as they're out of these mound nests. They're not brooded by their parents. They get out of the nest and fly off. So pterosaurs generally are more like that. So you have these...
The term's precocial, right? So they're
precocial.
Okay.
There, now some of the island pterosaurs, the big marine ones, they may have been caring for the young for a while because they don't show up in the marine sediments until they're fairly large, although not fully grown. So they may be more like albatross in that regard. But, it may have been that the young of the giant pterosaurs of the Cretaceous were competing with small pterosaurs, so the small pterosaurs went out. So this is just being sorted out these days.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Gregory S. Paul, renowned researcher and illustrator who helped establish the new look for pterosaurs, dinosaurs, and other Mesozoic creatures. And we're talking about his new book, which I strongly recommend, The Princeton Field Guide to Pterosaurs. Greg, let's talk generally about pterosaur body types. The rhamphorhynchoids, the early ones, I remember these from the had these long tails.
Yeah.
And that just goes away, and it ends up, it seems like the general body type is a huge head and a small body.
Yeah, and a little bit similar happens with birds, and then birds start out with long tails, and then they lose them.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and that's probably because it increases flight dynamics. You don't have a long tail that kind of slows down your ability to turn and that sort of thing. So, but it's a bit iffy as to why that occurs and why it becomes exclusive. So the pterodactyloids do that. So, yeah, the pterodactyloids generally go for a really big head on a relatively small body. That's one of the reasons they look weird. You don't really see that today.
Yeah. They really look strange. I mean, it looks like they would have to, I don't know what, if they're eating a lot of food, it's not going anywhere. There's not a lot of where it's going to go. There's just not a lot of body there.
Yeah, and it's somewhat mysterious why they're doing it.
Yeah.
But then again, remember, maybe birds are weird. You know, maybe they're ones. Maybe why do they have such big bodies? They're flying around. Why don't they have smaller bodies like pterosaurs?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So it's partly the way one looks at it. So pterosaurs are doing it, so it works.
We were talking about crests, and crests, when they're present, had a tendency to get really, really large, and the variation in the crests is just amazing. When I think of Nyctosaurus, Gracilis,
yeah.
I don't even understand. Greg, I don't even understand how that works. Like,
and for a long time, we didn't even know Nyctosaurus had those things. It was only fairly recently that some specimens were.
Well, let's describe what that crest is like, because that crest looks longer than the body.
Yeah, it's a crest that's very, very, two crests. One, they're both very long, thin straps. One goes from the top of the head and just goes up at it's kind of like a swept wing, but extremely thin. Goes up a good way, and then there's another one that projects straight out to the back from the base. It's not quite as long. Now, it's possible there was a membrane between those things, so it may have been even larger in area. We just don't really know. So, yeah, they have something to do with display. That's really the only probably sexual display, you know, gone wild like peacock tail feathers. And it apparently didn't do them any harm. You know, these are very thin crests, so they weren't causing a lot of drag. And that's probably their basic function.
Now, we know that almost all the pterosaurs were carnivorous, but you write that there was one that at least could have partially been herbivorous?
Yeah, they just a little bit may have been eating fruits and that sort of thing.
Now, the ecological niches that they fall into are really sort of interesting. There were those that seemed like they were albatrosses, that they sort of flew out over the oceans for long periods of time and lived on islands or on the coast. And then there were ones that ranged more inland. And they also, there's findings that they were able to survive cold weather.
Yeah, there used to be, when we were young, the thought that the only things that really had high metabolic rates were warm-blooded called endothermic, were basically mammals and birds. And we now understand, and it was, of course, people like John Ostrom and Robert Bakker who started revolutionizing on that. And it's now understood that a whole bunch of animals, including even some rather clunky Paleozoic reptiles, probably had elevated metabolic rates. It's much more common. And the big advantage of having one of the big advantages of having an elevated metabolism is you have higher exercise capacity. You can sustain high levels of activity for a longer time. It's one of the reasons pterosaurs had high metabolic rates, just to be able to fly around a lot. You know, there are no sustained flying low metabolic rate animals. It just doesn't work. And that was actually fairly accepted for pterosaurs. There was a lot of people, even in the 1800s, were saying, oh, these are high metabolic rate animals.
Yeah.
The other advantage of high metabolic rates is you can deal with cold weather and stay, you know, active. And we now know that the poles back at those times, they weren't nearly as vicious as they are today. But they were chilly. You know, it was getting dark for a long period of time. You would have snowfalls in the winter, and you don't have any sun to heat you up. So, and yeah, we're finding pterosaurs up there. There's just a paper that came out recently that actually shows that even in the end of the Triassic, there was a huge extinction of animals.
Yeah.
Probably due to volcanic eruptions along the Mid-Atlantic Rift that was just forming. And they point out that the dinosaurs may have survived because they were the one group that could deal with the resulting cold weather from that. And even then, the dinosaurs tended to be up at high latitudes because the equator back then was so viciously hot. So pterosaurs, yeah, they're doing that, something along those lines.
What was a great chapter for me was about them walking. There are now fossil pterosaur tracks that we have. Could they run? Could they swim?
Yeah, sure, they can run. In fact, one of the trackways shows a pterosaur doing that at quite a pretty rapid clip. And, yeah, they could swim, too. You know, they're pneumatic. They're going to be buoyant. They're going to float. And a lot of them have, if it may be universal, that they have webbed feet. They could swim, bob on the surface and swim around. So they were good walkers. There's controversy about exactly how they walked. Some are saying that a lot of them had fully erect limbs like mammals and birds tend to do. But I'm disagreeing with that because the trackways indicate that's not quite true, and their arms seem to be sprawling out. But still, some of them had a narrow gauge trackway by having the elbow pointed down 90 degrees. So but they were reasonably capable on land, but probably not as much as birds, which may have been a problem for them.
But what do we know?
Birds have the advantage of decoupling. The hind limbs aren't involved in the wings.
Yeah.
So the hind limbs can be used just for moving about on land to the point you have some fully terrestrial birds. The pterosaurs have that problem that wing membrane is connected to the legs in some way, and the tail membrane too, so they're somewhat more limited.
Do we know how they took off, especially these larger species like Quetzalcoatlus?
There's an argument.
Michael
Habib and others are making that they were quadrupedal. They took off quadrupedally like bats.
Oh.
And that makes sense. On the other hand, that doesn't preclude them from sometimes taking off bipedally, by running. I wouldn't think there's some debate about that.
But was it like watching an albatross take off? I mean, albatrosses have problems landing. I know that. We don't know anything about the mechanics of how they landed or took off.
Well,
exactly.
Some of the big marine pterosaurs like Nyxosaurus have really small hind limbs, so they may have had problems landing.
Okay.
They
crash like an albatross does when it comes in?
May have.
God.
Now, remember, one of the incredible things, these giant pterosaurs, the Ashdarchids, the big ones, they're weighing as much as lions, maybe bears. And I was the first person to note that. Have you ever heard about the QN project back in the 80s, led by Paul McCrady?
Mm-hmm.
And I was involved with that. I did the design work. And the argument was that Quetzalcoatlus, with a wing about 35 feet across, weighed only as much as a human being. And because that's the only way it could fly. And I was working on the skeletal restoration, and I just realized it's just not possible that these things weighed way more than that. And Paul and other people are saying, oh, it's just not possible. You can't fly. if you weigh that much. But sailplanes, some of the lower sailplanes have the same wingspan, and when you put a human being in them, they weigh the same amount, so they work. And even the really high-performance sailplanes, they often actually put water ballast in them to make them heavier, because if you're soaring, you're using gravity as your power source. So, some of these things were weighing a few hundred pounds, or bigger, much significantly bigger than ostriches. So when you hear that ostriches can't fly because they're too big, no, it's because they don't have wings. And it may be not possible for birds to be that big and fly, partly because the wing feathers had to get ridiculously long, the outer ones, so they can't do that.
What do we know about their diet? Obviously they probably, especially the marine ones, ate fish. Some of the species had these weird sort of crooked teeth that stuck out of the sort of jutted out of their beak. But as you write, the teeth probably weren't for chewing. They probably swallowed stuff whole, right?
Yeah, those are for just snagging fish. And then they would, one or another get that fish reoriented with the head towards the throat. And a lot of these pterosaurs have big throat pouches like pelicans. I shouldn't say it's pelicans because that's too big. But, the back third of the lower jaw, they have this upward curve where they had a throat pouch. So they might put the fish in there initially and then swallow it later or whatever. So, yeah, they were using the teeth to snag, and then, like a lot of modern birds, they can't they can only pick up the fish and then have to swallow it whole.
And they probably had to rest on water if that was the case, because that happens now with things like gannets. If they eat too big a fish...
I don't know about that, if I would want to rest in the water back in those days.
Okay, because there's a lot of other things going on in the water.
Of the birds that rest on the water, albatross feed on resting on the surface. But they actually do that in somewhat cooler waters where there aren't that many animals ready to snack.
Like sharks, yeah.
So you're talking about a lot of tropical waters that had, mosasaurs and ichthyosaurs and plesiosaurs that would, I'm sure, would like to snack on a floating... Pteranodon or whatever.
Let's talk about Pterodostro. When I first saw years ago the restoration of the fossils of that, that's when I started going, there's obviously something going on in this group of animals. I have no idea. Pterodostro was a filter feeder and had an upturned beak like an avocet does, but not as dramatic. And apparently filter fed like flamingos do.
Yeah, it's a very flamingo-like system, except flip it around, because flamingos, the beak curves downward forward. This one curves strongly upwards. But yeah, they were filter feeding in rather nasty types of water like flamingos do that are you don't want to drink the water, but you got a lot of brine and shrimp type in it, that sort of thing. Little creatures that they can scoop up that way.
Wow. Now, do we know if they've nested in colonies, like gannets do or other seabirds?
Yeah, there's a nesting site down in South America that indicates that for one pterosaur, and maybe some other ones too. But and almost certainly the ones nesting on islands were doing that. Because, the advantage of that is you're on an island, it's free of predators, so you can have big colonies without being the parents and the eggs and the juveniles being attacked all the time.
Now, we just have a few minutes left. What do we know about why they became extinct? Was it the same general reasons that dinosaurs became extinct? Was it the big, asteroid hit, or was it a combination of other factors?
Almost certainly the asteroid had a lot to do with it. There was also the Deccan traps in India, and we're putting a lot of volcanics into the air. I like that word, Deccan traps. And but at least the asteroid did it. So, yeah, they certainly would have survived a lot longer had it not been for the events at the end of that boundary. Because, you had a lot of bad stuff going on, the original pyrosphere around the planet, as the debris from the impact re-entered the atmosphere and caused it to become a glowing furnace. That wouldn't have been good for these exposed animals. And then it became, really cold initially because of all the dust. Then the CO2 in the atmosphere superheated things up. Just not a good situation. And from what we can tell, it looks like the birds that survived were basically modern-type birds that have these manipulative beaks that allow them to feed in this bad environment. And also they were the nesting birds that were brooding their young. and pterosaurs weren't doing that. And that those two features may have caused the birds to be able to be archosaur flyers that survived, and the pterosaurs couldn't do that. All the pterosaurs were big and had relatively small adult populations, so they probably that probably was a contributing factor.
Did they have feathers?
Oh, they have what may be the same ancestral thing as feathers. It's not feathers. They're more fur-like, and they're hollow, but they may well share the same ancestry. Those things may go back to proto-dinosaurs and proto-pterosaurs, the basal ornithodirons. And so you wouldn't call them feathers, although they're the same homologous type of structures. Unlike, we sometimes call it pterosaur fur, but it's not mammal fur, which is evolved separately. And mammal fur is except in, I think, polar bears, is solid. It isn't hollow fibered.
Now, just before we go, it's easy to get all interested in the huge pterosaurs, but there are some really small pterosaurs, like the Anurognathus.
Yeah. Yeah.
The head shape on that was really, they look like flying frogs.
And to a certain extent, they were. They were the equivalent of swifts and swallows, in that they were insect hunters, and flying at high speeds, low to the ground.
When we're talking small, how small are we talking?
It's hard to compare pterosaurs in a way to birds because they have their body weight relative to the wingspan is so much lower.
Yeah,
you're talking about the size of a robin or something like that,
basically. Wow.
And so they were small little things, very high performance flyers. And they would be doing the same thing that swallows and swifts are doing today.
There's so much more in this book. It's absolutely amazing. My guest tonight has been Gregory S. Paul, renowned researcher and illustrator, who helped establish the new look of pterosaurs, dinosaurs, and other Mesozoic creatures. And we've been talking about his new book. It's an incredible book to look at, but it's important to read it, too. The Princeton Field Guide to Pterosaurs. Greg, it's been a pleasure.
Been a pleasure too on my side.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.